You can destroy a forest in a day, but you certainly can't create one in a day, not even in a decade. The Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project, called just AFR by nearly anyone connected to it, has worked for years to make the critical forested slopes of the Ashland watershed resistant to fire. A hot fire on those slopes could mess up the city and its water supply big time. AFR features regular controlled burns, one of which got a bit less controlled last year. It took out some trees that were not supposed to burn. So now project managers are looking at replacing the lost trees with sugar pines, which are not so common in the area these days. Two guests with us. Don Boucher is the AFR project manager with the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. Don, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Darren Borges is involved with the project as well. He is the Southwest Oregon Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy. Hi, Darren.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
So how far along, Don, in general, is the AFR project? We mentioned it, you know, you can't do it in a year, you can't do it in a decade, it seems.
Well, we originally signed a 10-year agreement in 2010, so we're getting close to the end of that. We're 8 years into it, and we've treated roughly about 6,000 out of the 7,600 acres that we're set out to do.
That's definitely getting close to the end of things. How often do you burn up there, and how much material do you burn?
Well, we have a large amount of piles, which are the result of the piling the slash from doing the treatments. And then that's just part of the initial treatment. And then we're moving into maintenance now of some of the treated areas, and that's where we're doing the underburning.
So the treatments you're talking about, you're taking out a lot of the smaller fuels and things like that, just to sort of clear things out and make more of an open forest floor.
Yeah, those fuels that are flashy, that burn easily, and that will put fire into the canopy of trees. We've really focused on those and the smaller trees, trying to maintain that older forest and so that's been the focus of the treatment so far. And then as we move into maintenance, what we want to do is maintain those conditions over time rather than let it all grow back and start from scratch again.
We've been corrected on our terminology that the controlled burn last July did not get out of control. It stayed within the boundaries, but there were some unanticipated consequences within the burn boundary. So what happened there?
Well, essentially, we had an unanticipated heat generated from the amount of fuel that was on the forest floor that we were trying to basically get rid of. It was an interesting situation in that we didn't really burn any trees. It was just the amount of heat that was generated and lifted up through the canopy that scorched the trees as opposed to actually burning them.
And so what kinds of trees were we talking about here that got taken out, and how critical were they how much were hopes pinned on these trees being there?
Oh, well, the burn units that we're talking about and the small proportion where we had the excessive scorch is just a tiny fraction, less than 1% of the entire project area that we're working in. We're concerned about a number of patches, anywhere from 2 to 20 acres where this scorch occurred. And most of the trees that were scorched were, young Douglas firs. But we are particularly concerned about, losing any of the large old trees, what we call legacy trees. They're 150 years or older, and they've got the large structure and stature and height and thick bark that typically would leave them resistant to a mild fire running across the forest floor. So, it's really the legacy trees that kind of stand out as the sort of the pinch point, the hard knock that we took in this particular event.
So Don Boucher, I mean, when you make a plan for anything, especially when you're on a project where resiliency is the middle name, I mean, you're going to have to figure that some things will not go exactly as you intended. So I just wonder how much resiliency is built into the resiliency plan for, do-overs when things didn't go quite what you thought would happen.
Well, before we even start a burn, we have a pretty detailed plan that prescribes the kind of conditions that we'll burn in, temperature, humidity, fuel moistures, and that. And when you start to burn larger areas, you get a lot of variability in those conditions. And then you throw in the mix of having a a lot of people out there putting fire on the ground and trying to move the fire through. Essentially, putting fire on the ground is one of our biggest challenges, because it's not, if you're talking in terms of operating, it's more of a hammer than a scalpel.
Right. It is not a very sharp instrument.
Yeah. Right. But what we do build in is a lot of those conditions which we think will be successful in completing it. And nature has its own way of adapting to things. But what we've done is spent some time looking at what we did, how we did it, and learned a few lessons that we'll incorporate into the next time, which hopefully this spring we'll have some times to get some burning in.
So let me cast it in future tense. In addition to looking at what happened in the controlled burn itself, I mean, as you look ahead to like, okay, now how do we rectify what happened here that we didn't want to happen? Darren Borges, how do you draw up the plans for that sort of thing? Like, well, okay, so we lost some legacy trees. Now what do we do?
Yeah. Well, the key thing, there was an after-action review. That means every member of the team from the Forest Service and the Grayback contract crews and Lomakatse and the Nature Conservancy sat in a circle in that burn unit and talked about the results that we found and all of the contributing factors we could think of. And so, you know, it's really boiling down to better site preparation. We've got to keep the crews building piles further away from the legacy trees and make sure that we're not leaving any that are unburned when we come back for the what we call the underburn or the broadcast burn. And secondly, especially on these steep slopes where there's a tendency almost to, as you're walking, and ideally on the contour, we've got to work with the crews to encourage them to stay on that contour and not fall downhill. Because as they go downhill further, what we're getting is more fire on the hillside than intended. So we've got to slow down the crews, improve communications, and then really it's about better site prep on all of the units where we'll be doing burning in the future.
We're talking about the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project and some things that happened last year and some rectification moves that are going on right now. We're talking to Don Boucher, who's the project manager for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, and Darren Borges, who is with the Nature Conservancy. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So do the legacy trees have to come down, or will they fall down? Will they be cut down?
Legacy trees? Alive and dead are both important habitat structure for wildlife. So it's really important that they stand there. There's no intent to do any further thinning. So, but what we want to move into now is especially in these openings that have been created in many of our units where we've done the thinning and then the underburning, there's more open and sunlit conditions where we can transplant in some of the native sugar pine that need that more open light. And that's really what we were announcing to volunteers and looking to help build our force out there to start transplanting sugar pines into some of these openings.
And you're actually asking people to come out and help you plant these on Saturday, is that right?
That's right. We've got a full slate of volunteers who've already signed up and plans to guide their endeavors, teach them how to do the transplanting, supervisors suggesting on how to find appropriate microsites so that those seedlings will have a chance to survive. They're just little one-year babies.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you need any more volunteers? Can people still sign up or can they come out and watch?
We've got all that we can handle. Don, I don't know the number exactly.
Yeah, somewhere between 25 and 30 people will be out this weekend. With the number of trees that we have, we may possibly have another time to ask for more volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
We've already lined up a couple of student groups from SOU and one of the classes to help come out and plant. With the number of trees that we have, there are other places in the watershed that we'd like to get the sugar pine back in, and so it's not just the burned area where we'll plant trees.
A sugar pine is native, but has had some problems over the years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Sugar pine is actually a really impressive tree, one of my favorites. They get huge. They get over 200 feet tall. I've measured individual trees in the Ashland watershed pushing up against 7 feet in diameter.
Wow.
And they have these beautiful kind of asymmetrical, somewhat flat-topped crowns. And then from the branch tips, they've got these 20-inch long pendant cones. So they really stand out. They're naturally scattered across the forested landscape. They only show up in about a third of a forest plot of the forest plots if you put them out there to inventory. And they're in decline. They were a target for logging. Post settlement, they take the middle bole. Often it's a big tall chunk of wood without any branches. So mm-hmm. you have this clean, clear, straight wood. It's light. It's strong. It was used for shake roofs, and it became really important during the height of the pear industry for building fruit boxes.
Boxes, I'm sure, yeah.
Right, right. So it was almost hunted down across the landscape to find enough material, and so it's in decline there. And then now it's sort of boxed in by four threats that are reducing the numbers. Those four threats, obviously the historic timbering, the forests have become crowded, and that's increased the stress on the adult trees, and so they're kind of just...
Well, if they're sunlight loving, it's going to be hard for them, yeah.
Well, and or if they need water and nutrients mm-hmm. from the soil, if there's too many trees down below them, they're not getting everything they need, and so they become susceptible to bark beetle attack. And then third, there's this non-native introduced fungus called a blister rust, originally from China, brought over on horticultural plants to the Northwest, probably 1910, 1920. And it gets established underneath the young bark of young trees and will girdle them and kill them. It'll also blank out branches on adult trees. And it spreads, and it's preventing, essentially, the regeneration of a young sugar pine crop to come back up. Where they're, you might see some old trees, but the young trees are dying.
So if you do what I did, which is look up sugar pine on Google, blister rust is mentioned in the second sentence as that big a challenge. So what can you do to ensure the survival of what gets planted in the Ashland watershed?
It's a big challenge, and it's a challenge not only for sugar pine in Ashland and sugar pine all up and down the West Coast from the Central Cascades here in the Klamath Mountains all the way down the Sierra and to Baja, Mexico. And it, along with other five-needled pines like white bark pine in the alpine, subalpine environment and also western white pine, are all susceptible.
We talked about white bark pine just last week.
So the seedlings that we're putting in were grown from orchard-grown trees that were grown from stock seedlings that were originally taken from seed collected from adult trees that appeared to have some inherent genetic resistance to the disease. A little bit of breeding in there in these orchards, and now they're producing essentially disease-resistant seedling stock for any reforestation effort that involves sugar pine. That's what we're using.
So, Don, though, people can't think about seedlings like kittens, I would think. I mean, a bunch of them aren't going to make it when they get planted. Is that fair?
Yeah, it takes some good growing conditions for them to get established. And so we'll tend to, put a few more trees in than what we would expect to see actually grow up into those big trees that we want.
Mm-hmm. How long are we talking about? I mean, how long does it take to go from seedling that's below your knees to the tree that's over your head and maybe a foot thick?
Well, one of the neat things about sugar pine is the growth rate that they're able to sustain. Being able to push up to over 200 feet in height. So, but it's going to take, a decade for those trees to kind of get up to, head high and a little higher. And that's just enough time for them to be big enough to tolerate, some of them to tolerate the next underburn. Because our research shows here in the Ashland watershed and throughout the Rogue Basin and dry forests on the Pacific coast, again, from the Cascades, the Klamath, down through the Sierra, they all converge around having a fire return interval of about every 8 8 years.
8 years, okay. So even less than a decade. Yeah.
And frequent fire is what kept the forest open and kept the conditions highly appropriate and supportive for the growth of big sugar pine.
I realized as we were talking about this earlier, Don Boucher, that our vision of fire itself is different because of the years of fire suppression, that when a fire breaks out now, we expect it to get under the crowns and look all scary and make us scream and put our stuff in the car and run away. But in fact, I mean, fire, if left alone to do what it had done for eons through the landscape, doesn't look like that.
No, it basically just, for the most part, creeps around, and in some over dense areas it will actually, you know, burn up those trees in little pockets. But rather than these massive walls of flame that you're seeing today, you'll just see little patches of trees that will just torch, and that's the extent of the high intensity fire. For the most part, it just creeps around, backs around where there's fuel, and results in a very nice condition.
So once the years of the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project are done, and when you get to the 10 years and shut it down, or, you know, if it goes a little longer, it goes a little longer, but when you get all 7,600 acres treated, will you then do deliberate burns? Will you just let natural burns happen? What's the plan for that?
Well, ultimately, when we get to some state, it's our goal to let natural fire take its place and do the work. Probably for the next 10 or so years out into the future, we're probably going to be putting fire down ourselves. We're just not to the point where ideally we would have covered a lot more of the landscape with treatments to get it back and then allow fire just to do its thing. But at this point, we'll try to maintain what we have. And in fact, we're discussing at this time that next phase, AFR 2.0, to look at how we deal with that in the future.
And if I might add, you know, the city of Ashland has established this surcharge on our water bills. I live in Ashland. I pay $1.39 a month to help sustain the maintenance treatments of AFR. It generates about $175,000 a year, and that funding stream was designed to meet the need for ongoing burning at about 1,000 acres per year in maintenance.
Okay, 1,000 acres a year. So how many people are showing up for the tree planting on Saturday?
Well, I just heard Don say, was it 25 or so?
Yeah, 25 to 30, somewhere in there.
That's a good-sized crew. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for bringing some details to us about the update on what's going on with the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project and the planting of the sugar pines. And we'll get to watch those grow over the next few years, it sounds like. Don Boucher is the project manager for the AFR. He is with the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. Aaron Borges is the Southwest Oregon Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy, one of the partners in the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project. You can see why people call it AFR in almost every reference. Gentlemen, thanks. Good to have you both here.
Thanks for having us.